You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This is episode number 6, Politics. Throughout the issue, we've been calling attention to the time frame when Joseph Bedford conducted the interviews, between 2021 and 2022, when the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and the murder of George Floyd were still catalyzing disciplinary introspection and politicization. The Black Lives Matter movement and protests produced a discourse across American culture that asked everyone to acknowledge the ways in which anti-Black racism was integrated into the world through institutions, policies, personal behaviors, etc. In academia, there were calls to decolonize curriculum, to hire a more diverse cohort of professors, and to address racial politics through pedagogy. The combination of COVID-19's reworking of social life and nationwide protests served to destabilize disciplinary architectural institutions and discourses. In the face of a public health crisis and racial reckoning, the concerns of academic architecture, such as the pitched roofs we discussed in the previous episode on aesthetics, seemed quaint and irrelevant to larger societal conversation. This generation responded to these circumstances with sweeping calls for change in the discipline, and especially leaned on a pluralistic, social justice vocabulary of engagement, inclusion, and expansion. The sense of a paradigm shift was in the air. Here's Curtis Roth, reflecting on the mood and revisiting the recorded debate between Michael Meredith and Mark Foster Gage at Cooper Union.
There was a perception that Trump being elected was a sea change. And in a weird way, I think that it actually wasn't that much of a sea change for architecture in 2016, 17, 18. That kind of shift actually did come later. It came with the summer of 2020, and it came with COVID. And I think it came actually even with, you know, the wildfires of 2018, 2019 in California, really apparent environmental crisis, which was, of course, apparent before, but is unavoidable in the public imaginary. I went back and I watched this Cooper Union debate. I mean... I don't mean to be rude, but it was hard for me to care about the kind of things that were being discussed in the Cooper Union debate because they seemed so insular to the world in which we've all been living in our apartments for the last year and like haven't been able to speak to each other. Like just seeing people together sitting side by side talking about something seemed like another world. And the kinds of things they were talking about also seemed like from another world in a way.
And Michael Young sums up the shift well.
Without a doubt, the questions of the last 2 years have cleared out some of the discursive jabbering that maybe was happening before.
We can read the Michael Meredith and Mark Foster Gage debate as exemplary of a largely apolitical disciplinary discourse that is concerned with constructing conflicting camps, close reading aesthetics, and situating work within intellectual, institutional, and disciplinary genealogies. It is unsurprising that in moments of political urgency, this mode of thinking would feel myopic. In this way, Black Lives Matter and COVID were both politicizing forces. Many architects who hadn't previously discussed politics were made to think about and present their work in political terms. Looking back at this generation's output pre-2020, there is very little obvious political positioning. Collective moments, like possible mediums, or the 44 low-resolution houses show, were disciplinary outings that had little interest in promoting a politics. The politicization of architectural discourse produced frictions that sometimes felt productive and at other times forced. Kyle Miller, Kyle Schumann, and McLean Clutter described this shift as a turning away from pre-2020 concerns and towards larger social and political issues.
A lot of the people that are affiliated with the Possible Mediums Project are embracing their role as one that cannot remain apolitical. And now, whether it's architecture's complicity in climate change or the exclusivity of building for only elite institutions and wealthy clients, I think is something some of my peers are confronting. I don't think any of them have the answer yet, but it's something that they're conscious about and working on. Whereas for a long time, it just wasn't something they had to think about. So a lot of the people that I, again, affiliate with in my generation, I think are now coming to terms with the fact that they definitely were not as attentive to these issues as they need to be. I don't know what that looks like yet. I think a lot of people are trying to retool their practices to be a protagonist in these broader issues. You look at, let's say, the latest work from people who have still been active in building, like Freeland Buck or LADG, the work itself still serves a particular demographic, and they themselves have maybe become more engaged and political or active, but I don't think it's reflecting yet in the work, and that will take time to kind of undo the habits of the 2010s and find an aesthetic that's more immediately of its time. And that's a challenge. I mean, I think a lot of my peers, they took a half decade or more to hone in on an aesthetic sensibility that is now the one that they have to challenge or let evolve such that it more consciously engages with the issues that are, again, now just demanding attention and are a kind of requirement to engage with.
A lot of the work now needs to be ready to be discussed in political terms, whether that's the original intention or a primary driver behind the work or not, just because political discourse is expanding and accelerating. And so everybody has to be aware of it or be aware of their work being read in that way.
Going back to the 2010s, I think that there are quite a few people in our generation, especially who were educated in a way that never necessarily asked them to come to grips with the political agendas of their work and the political agendas implicit in the aesthetics. What I personally observe now is a combination between, amongst some, a feeling of paralysis as we puzzle through what matters anymore. The paralysis is maybe intensified amongst those who never have necessarily taken account of what might be the political that's wrapped up in their aesthetic.
Despite the doubt or uneasiness around how the discipline would truly metabolize the politics of the day, we heard unanimous support for the Black Lives Matter movement and a clear feeling that the killing of George Floyd was not just a question of police brutality, but evidence of a need for change in many facets of life, including architecture and academia. Here are Bryony Roberts, Jerome Hafford, and Kyle Schumann on their perception of the atmosphere at the time.
What I see in front of me is people interested in practice and driven by a kind of social justice position. So drawing from this intersection of anti-racism, feminism, disability justice, you know, economic justice, all this. And so there are very big ambitions in terms of how there needs to be, you know, systemic change in order to change the profession and completely rethink its relationship to the people it's supposed to be serving.
I do think that we've experienced this reckoning around race and are in the process of the growing pains of what are these, frankly, generational calls to expand and grow as a discipline. The crisis for me, and I'm speaking a bit here, not only as someone who believes so much in our discipline and as a member of this generation, but then, you know, I guess also as a person of color, I think the question I have is, will people realize that some of these questions raised by this larger pandemic and racial reckoning, if these are fundamental questions that implicate all of us and implicate the generative capacity of all of us to reach a new level and reach new levels with this discipline, this thing we call architecture. I feel that people somehow don't seem to think that the questions raised apply to them or have anything to do with them. That is a tragic mistake. Let's take Afrofuturism, for example. There's so much there that anybody can draw upon and find generative and mine and grow the discipline. But I think people get turned off by the identity politics.
We were on some panels recently and certain people would kind of introduce themselves. First or second thing they would describe about their firm was all about diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's definitely like in a really positive way on the table and in the thinking of everybody now to just always kind of be aware of that, whether they're doing hiring or sort of the focus for a particular project or body of work. But there's also, I think a lot of people feel pressure to list that at the forefront of their motivations, and whether that is like actually like the first or second thing on somebody's list, or if it's a couple items down because they have other specializations that were pre-existing, I think is an interesting relationship.
While we won't hear any challenge to what Hafford referred to as the discipline's racial reckoning, he and others cast doubt on the intentions of the discipline as a whole. Not everyone was confident that the field would have long-term follow-through with efforts to improve diversity and promote anti-racism. With the benefit of hindsight, and coming from the first year of the second Trump administration, and a full-blown DEI backlash that is specifically targeting academia, this lack of faith feels prescient. Here's Kyle Miller on how he saw the outpouring of support for Black Lives Matter around him at the time.
I hope it's genuine. I suspect much of it is performative, and again, a kind of requirement of meeting demands placed upon institutions by the market. And that's too bad, but at the very least, it comes with a sense of awareness and acknowledgement that everyone is forced to confront, even if it's just through a headline. You know, I've heard people say in recent months, like, I wonder how long this is going to last. And I think some of them are asking it, meaning, I hope it lasts. And others are asking it, thinking, I wonder how long we have to keep performing for others.
However, other members of this generation understood and accepted that this moment of cultural consensus would pass, that those who felt forced to show their support would resume business as usual as soon as possible, and that the work of building up a political discourse within architecture would continue. Here are Brittany Udding and Mira Henry.
I think that a lot of us are reflecting not just on the latest atrocity or issue in the news cycle. People have been working on issues of property, of collective life, on environmental violence for decades. And so I think that there's moments where the news cycle happens to align with those issues, but there's also kind of broader, deeper discourses that have been unfolding carefully, being slowly unpacked and reimagined, that have been happening for decades. It's important not just to look at the trend or the news cycle, but to look to discourses and practices that have been working on these issues for a while.
That's where the struggle is, understanding the politics of one's work, its legibility and resonance outside of highly internal conversations. Certainly the last 3 years has been catapulted by all of the cultural meltdown that we've been experiencing, but I think it's been building too. It's not like it's the first time that people are all of a sudden talking about politics and trying to orient themselves to economy, to identities.
So far, we've established the context of these interviews as at the high watermark of a politicizing moment for the discipline, which asked academic architects to consider the politics of their work in new ways. We will take up what we heard Henry refer to as the struggle, this linkage between politics and architectural work, through the rest of this episode, and hear from this generation on how they understand their ability or inability to do political work through design. We'll discuss the way this generation integrated politics into their work as teachers, as aesthetic producers, and as employers. As a group of academics, one of the key sites where this generation saw an ability to align themselves with the anti-racist politics of the day was through their teaching. The question of how race intersects with architectural education leads to a longer list of questions, like who is teaching architecture and who is studying it, who's included in the canon, and what is assigned on syllabi, and how are racial histories of the built environment taught? What is central and what is marginal to the discipline? Curtis Roth, Niran Turan, and Kyle Miller all describe how they've begun rethinking the way architecture is taught.
If I think about a lot of the work that's happening at schools today, I think there's a real commitment, even in the last 2 years, to challenge a lot of the basic assumptions about how we learn architecture, how we teach architecture, how we evaluate architecture. And I think this has shown up in different ways in which studios are imagined. Like, studios are run in completely different ways all over schools around the US today than they were even a year ago or whatever. The thing that is very encouraging about that is that one of the things that has emerged with that conversation is a kind of direct engagement with the material politics of architecture.
most people are sitting down and saying, you know, what is about the life after 2020? I don't know. I mean, it's impossible as an intellectual, as a person who's thinking, it's impossible to be indifferent to all of those transformations right now around pedagogy, around question of canon, what is core and how do you teach it? How do you define it? Like, all of these things are real. Like, it's just happening as we speak. And I would find it probably impossible for anyone who's just teaching in the kind of context of the United States right now not to be confronted with those questions. Yes, maybe they will just, some of them will close the doors and say, you know what, it's going to pass. I'll wait for another 5 years.
Certainly, this is probably one of the more significant collection of events in our lifetime, and it seems impossible that the impact that it made on me will be short-lived. Even if some of the changes I've made are minimal, they're not temporary. I think how architecture schools are situated or how they're organized, I don't imagine those changes to be temporary. Notions of it being more inclusive in terms of global histories and theories and even things like precedent lists, there's a real tangible value to be more exhaustive globally when studying the work of the past and to expand the canon, not to erase it or replace it, but to just expand it to make the academic environment more inclusive and reflective of the student population. I think it's easier for me to imagine how that translates in academics than in practice.
One clear shift that this generation described in their pedagogical approach was a positive acknowledgement of the subjectivity behind architectural production. While in the past, this might have seemed insufficiently abstract or too personal, it was regarded in this cultural moment as a tactful recognition of our individual entanglements with politics via our racialized, gendered, classed experience. Here are Jerome Hafford, Cyrus Penarroyo, and McLean Clutter, arguing that addressing one's own position in society and culture allows for a deeper engagement with architectural questions.
There's a little bit more of an acknowledgement that we, the authors of these things, are also political actors and bodies within this work, whether we would like to admit that or not, versus this obsession and fetishization of end products, so to speak, and this complete divorcing of the makers of this stuff from it.
What I've witnessed, at least, is that perhaps that's a moment of a certain kind of identity politics, but it is also imbricated chaos in a lot of other political agendas and political sensitivities. So I don't think it has been limited to a certain kind of identity politics. I think, like, for example, pedagogically, the way that it's moved through this school is less about identity politics per se, and more about epistemic brackets, like what it means to be a discipline, whether or not that has historically and necessarily excluded certain ways of knowing and thinking about the built environment, and how we might rethink those boundaries to let other kinds of epistemologies into our education.
By acknowledging one's own position and privilege and experience, that becomes a way to make one's politics explicit. I don't know if it necessarily sort of shoehorns you into identity politics per se, but I think part of the work right now that a lot of different practices are doing has to do with actually acknowledging one's own positionality and subjectivity. And that becomes a way to sharpen or clarify one's worldview.
What Cyrus has said reminds me of this conversation that we had here when we were reviewing the thesis awards projects. And I was just recognizing that maybe 10, 15 years ago, if a student introduced a thesis project, shot through with their own subjectivity or their own kind of personal story or position, I thought, and also I was tutored to believe, that that was somehow not answerable to the higher demands of the discipline, that to make the project too personal bracketed its impact around the personal, and it wasn't answering these kinds of larger societal or disciplinary questions. And I was just observing how, when I reviewed projects like that this year, I reacted very different. I reacted thinking that these were students who, like as Cyrus said, had thought about their own positionality vis-a-vis the world and the kinds of power dynamics that that positionality might open up.
Next, we'll turn to the thorny question of how aesthetics can relate to politics. Despite this generation's focus on aesthetic and formal concerns, they were largely unconvinced by the ability of aesthetics to operate politically or to be instrumental for positive political action. any one-to-one relationship between an aesthetic and political project seemed too easy, too metaphorical, too cheap. They saw meaning as free-floating, and architecture as unable to reliably communicate a politics, leaving them in a murky territory where they were attempting to integrate political perspectives into their work, but didn't really see their skill set or interests as politically operative. Ashley Bingham, Eric Herman, Michael Meredith, and Andrew Holder all expressed this lack of alignment.
The form can be deceiving. Say there's an interest in a formal casualness or a nonchalantness of form. I don't think that means that those practices are apolitical or they're nonchalant towards politics. I don't think it maps one-to-one, and I don't think it's fair to assign someone's politics without being more specific, like about either a particular project or practice.
An equivalency between forms and politics is really dangerous. I wouldn't want to equate a certain category of forms with a certain type of politics. I don't know how you do that, because I think we've all seen buildings in the world instrumentalized in horrible ways and in beneficial ways. And I don't think that their forms, particularly like their character or style, is deterministic of how they'll be used.
The politics of the aesthetics is never resolved, and it can mean something else.
There is something in contemporary cultural production that makes it very difficult to be a strong author, making strong claims about performance, particularly if you're expecting performance to show up in the social sphere. Like, no one believes that a house is going to save the world or make, you know, racial inequality go away.
Cyrus Penarroyo and McLean Clutter build on this line of thinking and discuss their loss of faith in the political instrumentality of aesthetics. Throughout the group, there was a sense that the formal and aesthetic qualities of work were no longer the only possible vector for politics, and questions of labor, economy, and occupation became ways to evaluate the political position of a project.
More recently, maybe in the past couple of years, the implicit politics are now being forced to become explicit. You know, I think that that is the struggle that a lot of practices are having to confront, is how can you be more obvious about your politics in the work that you're doing? And I think that that's something that we've asked ourselves, but also I think we've been pretty explicit about political views and what the work means and what it's contributing.
It's less that I don't believe in the claims around the aesthetic that I would have personally made in the early aughts. I think I still believe in that, but I think that what I ponder now is, what is enough? Is that enough to make the claims? Mm-hmm. We did a project for M&A Gallery in Los Angeles called Lossy Lossless, and it was a kind of storefront. They had a storefront space on Sunset for a little bit. Using the aesthetic categories we were talking about before, I think it had a kind of interest in the casual and the way a casual, formal, and material organizations might afford the possibility for new kinds of social interaction. And I still believe that. I think like what we designed works like that, not on the level of prescription, but on the spatial and aesthetic level of affordance. It makes certain things possible. However, beyond the fact that it's a project that I am very proud of and I love, it was a tremendous failure in terms of doing what it was supposed to do, which was to make a venue for conversation about gentrification in the neighborhood, because nobody, including us, programmed it. Nobody was deliberate about the way those formats for engagement might happen. Nobody thought about, or at least we didn't think about, who and what would feel welcomed into this environment that we created. So it's not that I think that the way we organized it doesn't work on the level of affordance. I still believe in those kinds of claims. I just don't think it's enough. I don't think the OMA project is going to create new audiences and new forms of public engagement. And that means that we don't have to think about the labor practices that went into its creation, for example. Again, it's about what is enough now and where we also draw the line and what we're going to describe as part of the political project and whether or not we get to choose.
Some went even further with their critiques of academic architecture's emphasis on aesthetics. For Paul Preisner and Brittany Utting, aesthetics were not politically operative, and instead represented disciplinary self-isolation and the maintenance of class-based hierarchies of taste.
My understanding of how architecture can fit within a class politics and why I'm trying to be intellectually resistant to things like aesthetics as a priority, because to me, those always eventually just get to notions of taste as the kind of definition of whether it's successful or not. And taste seems like such a gross thing to me because it is always a kind of flow of class from upwards to downwards, which means it has to do with money and power and control. And I think distasteful things have the ability to actually be offensive to some, and the some that it's distasteful to or offensive to are always those that are kind of in control of things, because it comes from things that are thought of as bad taste, whether it's in clothing or film or music or whatever. They upset the sensibilities of those who believe that the world is theirs and that they're the main beneficiaries of.
Party politics is not the same as a metapolitics. A metapolitics is the way that we live together. It's the way that we define a city. It's the way that we care for each other, the way that we recognize our own identities and express that. And I think that an architecture needs to respond to a metapolitics through issues of housing, through issues of material extraction, through understanding how the construction of a city is a profoundly political act and a profoundly necessary act. I struggle with the trendy ways of saying cool down, keep it simple, let's be indifferent, let's be ambiguous, because I think maybe I sound naive, but I deeply believe in the importance of architecture to address and meet our most pressing metapolitical issues of our day, which is housing, which is climate change, right? Which is ways that cities have been and infrastructures have been constructed literally to enable some people and to inflict violence on others. To strip architecture of its politics is a highly problematic act. And I don't think that loose forms reflect in any way a cooling off of architecture. I think to me, it looks like an entrenchment, a looking inward. It's a way of saying, hey, architects, we're just architects. We'll do villas over here while the world burns.
Preisner further developed this argument to argue that many aestheticized responses to political circumstances are not only ineffective, but mostly serve to soothe the conscience of their makers. Here's Preisner responding to contemporary aesthetic trends in architecture.
Some of it might just be a way to self-comfort oneself for being complicit in it. I mean, I'm just as complicit as everybody else in the kind of way society is. Some of the things like imagining buildings as characters seems like self-entertainment because of the despair that one might be in and not willing to fully accept.
Utting and Preisner's comments illustrate the difficulties of thinking through politics and architecture simultaneously. You can understand architecture as an art form, a concretization of social hierarchies, or a service to be provided for a client, each of which might offer different ways of thinking through how to engage with politics. What is specific to this generation, however, is their shared disciplinary inheritance, and the fact that most of their work exists in galleries or as installations and speculative projects. Their schooling and the scale of work they're able to produce means that despite their critiques or doubts about the ability for aesthetics to speak to politics, they are in conversations about aesthetics, representation, and form more frequently than they are in discussions of sustainable building practices or housing policy. Andrew Holder, when asked about the politics of this generation's aesthetics, described it as a marriage of materialist politics and architectural disciplinarity.
I have to see it as a move toward reinstantiating some kind of collective project. And I also have to see it as emerging out of two strands of architectural thinking that to date have always been assumed to be incompatible. So strand number one sort of originate from, I suppose, figures like Manfredo Tafuri, who were always admonishing us to consider the conditions of production of architecture and to properly analyze architecture as belonging to materialist discourse. Like at the end of the day, it's an economic activity and we have to read it that way. And so in order to be just and be responsible actors, we need to analyze architects as producers. I think they also, or we also feel as though the kind of materialist reading of our work is inevitable after the digital turn. We put the material conditions of production on the table and now we're left with it. All right, so that's kind of like bucket of stuff number one. Bucket of stuff number two would be less continentally derived and more kind of indigenous to American architectural education, where we are still trained to be readers of architecture and to somehow insist that the artifact itself has a kind of power. And maybe the way to understand that power or even like perform and recover it is through careful readership. I think that valuing of the artifact and readership as the device to confer value like has to maybe come out of, you know, the high postmodern and particularly, you know, a whole generation of people that Peter Eisenman trained. And for better or worse, like that is how many of us still approach architecture as though it's ends. In them have value detached from the system of authorship. And so I think we're left with the project of plugging those two things back together.
Where this plugging back together leads is an open question. Despite the skepticism we've heard, this group did identify a vein of aesthetics that they saw as responsive to the politics of the day, even if they didn't see them as particularly politically instrumental. They saw loose and informal composition as the strategy with the most credible claim for political meaning. We can see this looseness in individual projects as an acceptance of rough edges or sloppy details, a compositional strategy that casually gathers aggregate parts, and the incorporation of distinct aesthetics into a single whole. At the level of the discipline, we can also see this looseness in the pluralism of aesthetic projects. Diversity of aesthetic expression was valued from the scale of individual projects to the scale of the field as a whole. This permissive pluralism reads as a direct echo of the political emphasis on diversity and inclusion. Hans Tersak, Stuart Hicks, Meredith Miller, Jerome Hafford, and Kyle Reynolds all discuss loose, incomplete, or informal aesthetics in political terms.
That, I think, is a huge problem for pedagogues at the moment and instructors, which is basically like, how do you link up progressive politics to specific visual languages or even specific tectonic languages or even specific tools? It seems there's a deep pessimism and suspicion towards the ability of a visual school of thought to be able to carry those ideas, to express those ideas, unless it's like a kind of visual language that is particulate, aggregative, can be taken apart, reconfigured, things can be added, things can be taken away. You know, the visual language itself is like hyperplural and democratic in the sense that a community could disassemble it, reassemble it, add things, subtract things. It's both permanent and temporary. Everything to the point where it then becomes incoherent. That is a pretty common solution in recent studios, especially in the past couple of years. You know, again, like something that's particulate, aggregative, plural in its visual expression means that it's kind of difficult to call it a school of visual thought, a particular coherent formal language. So then it really becomes just kind of everything and nothing.
I think most people noticed when it started to happen. It was like one thing isn't enough. You have to have 50 of them and they have to come together. It kind of relates to the digital project of smoothness and just like everything being under the same thing. I'm a little less quick to ascribe a kind of one-to-one of lots of things coming together as a representation or symbol of the fact that we're all separate individuals. The way that we think about it is that we want to empower everyone's story to matter. If there are different things, people can see themselves in various parts and aspects, and then engage in their own way. It's not about a one-to-one sort of demonstration of different things coming together, but it does lead to an ability for individuals to engage in a collective way.
At least for a team, one thing that is important to us is that design, particularly in our building practice, that there's a sense of incompleteness. The non-smooth or the non-perfect is a way in which the kind of life of the building can have a place, and that there's a kind of openness to many possibilities, whether that's literally different possible uses, but I think also that people with different aesthetic sensibilities, different expectations, different relationships to architecture, that different people can find meaning in it.
We started to experiment with some of these clunkier shapes. I think we were maybe, and I was maybe drawing some different conclusions about some of that, which for me was really trying to diversify the canon of forms or even architectural precedents that we're thinking about. From really thinking about these ancestral, older origins and trying to play around with that a little bit, which then later on for me has become much more of an overt kind of cultural pedagogical project.
Some of the techniques or the interests in the looseness or informality of the way that things are put together was an attempt, at least an interest, to suggest that maybe we might be able to assemble or build some of these things without so much effort to develop or build or refine. A modernist set of details or sensibilities is incredibly time-consuming, difficult, and expensive. And so I think some of the underlying work is like, are there cheaper, easier, and less intensive ways of putting things together that more people could be a part of? The interest in building collectives to kind of expand the range of people that are potentially involved in this work is definitely an undercurrent.
In a similar line of thinking, material was of interest to this generation for its ability to contain multiple narratives and unfixed meaning. Here's Meredith Miller and Mira Henry.
Materiality is legible and accessible to many people, but it doesn't have a definitive message or meaning. But it has, I think, affiliations and, you know, evokes qualities and associations for people. And I think it can be connected to an idea of history, especially, again, with this legibility of the parts that have been recomposed in some new way. It's not blank. It's not empty or devoid of meaning, but I think the way in which those parts can be put together in a person's experience can vary. And so if there's a politics in that, I think maybe it has to do with stepping back and sort of allowing for a multiplicity of conclusions from the kind of like entourage of elements that the architecture puts into play.
Thinking about material is thinking about history and thinking about its relationship to exploitation, its relationship to physical extraction, colonialism. These are all very, very embedded in the ways in which we think about material as well. So it's this mix of both pleasure and tactility and the presence of material and the manners of working, but also histories and memories of that. So those things are very interwoven, and that's why it's hard to move on for us beyond just sitting in material practice.
However, this approach to aesthetics raises many questions about what political project is advanced through the embrace of pluralistic eclecticism. Rather than putting forward a singular project, a range of materials, aesthetics, and formal strategies are combined in an effort to maximize architecture's target audience. We can understand these aesthetic tendencies and populist attitudes as a response to the politics of the day, but we didn't hear an argument for their political power outside of their ability to be engaged with or enjoyed by a more diverse group of people. Finally, we'll turn to the question of architectural labor. The way architecture is produced was something that this cohort was increasingly conscious of, and it represented a way to take political action through financial structures and labor models rather than through design output alone. A key component of this discourse was the acknowledgement, as we heard from Holder previously, that architecture is an economic activity, which should be understood from a materialist point of view. This awareness further reinforces the difficulties in bringing a political project to bear on architecture. How can a designer reject, for example, racially motivated uneven development, when they're operating as a service provider for developers who have class interests which are antagonistic to an equitable built environment. Brittany Utting and Paul Preisner both see the economic role of architecture in the world as unavoidable and as a heavy counterweight to the political intent of any one architect.
Architecture is very much a spatial expression of private property, a spatial expression of industrial capitalism. It is a spatial expression of our energy paradigms. And if we don't acknowledge that, if we allow architecture to retreat into a purely sort of formal or aesthetic condition, then we just kind of give up.
Architecture is expensive. Even cheap architecture is expensive. Let's say more than a painting or more than it takes to write a song or something. It ends up being subservient to the capital it takes to produce it. And so it can't be too problematic to the bank. And then also because it's expensive, like really expensive, right? I think it has an inherent conservatism that's not necessarily wrong for big projects. No one wants to spend $300 million on a lark that might not work. And so I think the spectrum of risk that's taken is really kind of narrow in that sense. And so then within that spectrum, what ends up feeling open to creativity ends up being largely superficial parts of the project, things that don't jeopardize the relationship of the client or don't reconfigure the way life works too much as an experiment, because that might be distasteful or offend sensibilities. Architecture doesn't seem like it's constitutionally changed that much, even though the external aesthetics of it have changed quite a bit. I think it's rare that you have a project that really reconfigures how one thinks they should inhabit an architectural space, whether that's a home or an office or a museum or a courthouse. So program ends up being conventional most of the time.
The sense that architectural output alone was not sufficient for addressing the political valences of the built environment led directly into this cohort's high level of awareness around labor practices and the power dynamics that surround architectural production. There have been widespread critiques about the culture of unpaid labor across the field. Pushback frequently comes via social media, such as when Soil posted a job advertisement in 2023 with a salary range of 55 to 66K and an experience range of 3 to 8 years, or when a 2022 SIARC roundtable on professional norms advocated for 60-hour work weeks and argued that students should see their work as their life. Both dramas had real consequences, with Soil's pay range bumped up by $20,000 and with multiple faculty at SIARC resigning after public anger at the roundtable led to frank student discussions about the working conditions at professors' offices. We can also see this shift away from romantic notions of architecture as a calling through organizations like the Architecture Lobby, which have advocated for unionization and worker cooperation in the field. Here are Kyle Schumann, Ashley Bingham, Brittany Utting, and Daniel Jacobs.
There's been such a reliance historically on unpaid labor and these exploitative conditions. I mean, we saw that even a couple weeks or months ago with the news about the OMA job listing, right? Like no 9-to-5 mentality here. I mean, that's clearly existed for a long time. It's curious that they would still put that in a public job ad now, is maybe saying something about certain people's awareness of these ideas. We have an attitude that we refuse to take unpaid interns to work on our projects. There's a lot of good conversations and awareness about that now, just looking at improving working conditions and expectations. And that feeds into also just mentoring the new generation, right? Like fostering diverse voices, fostering people finding their own voice or areas of specialization within the discipline. There's a lot of benefits that I hope will come out of these conversations.
The way that we operate our firm, we've never had unpaid interns.
Leftist politics are increasingly relevant for a white-collar educated class. And we're seeing it not just in architecture, but in sort of so many different disciplines and so many different labor paradigms. People are refusing to accept the sort of status quo of precarity, of exploitation. And so increasingly, the kind of social and political and environmental issues of the left are becoming central to a lot of the ideological leanings of schools, especially as younger generations of academics enter these institutions.
And I do think that a lot of it in the academies, at least that we've been part of, has been a direct response from demands made by students. I teach a 130 student professional practice course at a 900 student architecture department in Texas. The University of Houston is a huge kind of engine driving the production of architecture here. And we did a session on unionization in the professional practice class, and the students loved it. And no one really brought up any issues as regards the kind of politics of that position.
For Meredith Miller, this concern around labor showed up in the many relationships and contracts that an architect finds themselves in while practicing. Rather than making claims for an architect's ability to produce a definitively political end result, Miller saw designers as one part of a larger system where they could exercise meaningful but limited power, including the power to refuse.
We are individuals in these ecosystems, and I think we have our own ethics. And I think one thing that team often discusses is what our ethics are within these various, you know, kind of assemblages of people that we are doing projects with, and what are the choices that we can make within those bounded roles. And when do we stop doing a project, or, you know, say no to a project, or try to influence things in a certain direction?
For some, the labor surrounding architectural production was also what drove their aesthetic choices. This link between back-end design labor and the aesthetics of the output makes a compelling case for how aesthetics can operate politically by making visible the labor behind architecture. Here are Curtis Roth and Kyle Miller.
Architecture's idea of authorship has, for a long time, worked to remove us from questions of politics, particularly the kind of politics of labor, because we can sort of imagine ourselves as somehow distinct from the labor of construction or even the labor of drafting, which is something that we're not involved with because we're kind of working in an abstract creative realm or something like that. And I really try to kind of avoid that distinction. A lot of the work that I've been doing recently has to do with economies through which things like renderings or images or digital files or whatever are produced, tracking those economies and trying to design different economic models through which people can relate to each other. And so in my mind, that is a project which is at once both about images, but also about the labor that goes into producing images and the money that goes into producing images and the global sites in which images are produced and so forth. And in a way, resists a distinction between distanced aesthetic things and engaged physical things.
I think of people like Curtis Roth and Lida and Gallo as deriving work from political and social situations. So Curtis's work on unpacking the politics of detailing and creating an aesthetic around that, I think, is just so brilliant. Tracking how a company in India is hired to draw waterproofing details, but then actually commissions a company in China, and then in China, the thumb drive gets on a boat and goes to North Korea, and somehow it comes back to Columbus, and Curtis makes a drawing of it. It's just aggressively out front in a lot of this new work, and the aesthetics are derived from politics.
Despite anxieties around the ability of architecture to adequately address the current political moment, there was a prevailing sense of optimism in this generation, and a desire to dig deeper into the ambivalent relationships between architectural production, aesthetics, and politics. While the interviewees were broadly hesitant to make political claims for their aesthetics, there was acknowledgement that the relationship between politics and aesthetics wasn't something to be ignored. This entanglement was one lasting effect of the politicizing moment of 2020. While we've spent much of this episode considering how practices with more aesthetically oriented disciplinary roots have tried to take on politics, Michael Young also sees a shift in how architectural conversations around politics have come to integrate aesthetic discourse. Here is Young and Katie McDonald.
You can go to a lecture today on political issues of social justice, discrimination, and colonialism, and hear very direct conversations about aesthetics. And I find that really encouraging and really interesting. Because a decade ago, if you said the word aesthetics, you would get run out of the room by people who were interested in social political discourse, because they would assume immediately that you were somehow subservient or compliant and complicit with structures of spectacle and capital, and thus not critical and political in any way. That's changed.
It's very convincing to me that the discipline would actually take on these questions at this time. It will take time for people to develop and mature those practices, just like it's taken them time to develop and mature their practice to wherever it is today. But I would say, what a great moment if the discipline can take on real social mission and real social change and not think about it as a separate project from form and theory, but actually think about them as integral to one another.
As the second Trump administration cracks down on diversity initiatives and political speech on college campuses, the question of where architects can find the agency to engage politically remains as pressing and challenging as ever. What we've heard in this episode sketches a series of points, from pedagogy, aesthetics, and labor practices, where architecture commingles with politics. While asking questions about how architecture can operate politically is useful, we didn't hear many answers in this episode, and certainly no specific political goals. How this generation will orient their practices in the shifting landscape of politics, culture, and the market remains to be seen. In our next episode, we will hear from this generation on the disappearance of disagreement in architectural culture, their critiques of prior modes of ideological debate in architectural academia, and the dominance of pluralistic ideology. You have been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture, issue 8, Talking About My Generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. The narration was written by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.